Well, bring out the zombie takeout.
I think zombie takeout's sleeping.
Well, I guess you'll just have to wake him up now, won't you?
Hello and welcome to Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get into all of the usual stuff, just a couple of things to go over. First off, would you like to just get all of the Right Said Fred, Midnight Oil, Uncle Fester jokes out of your system right off the top?
I don't know. It depends. Do you have a light bulb to put in your mouth or no?
For those listening to the audio version, particularly if you haven't seen the video version, I remember, and a couple of days ago, I shaved the beard that I'd had since then. So, yeah, I've got that look. The skin gets kind of interesting, just in case you notice anything. once you've had a beard for a while. A quick apology to anyone who had issues downloading the audio versions of our reviews of Open Mic Eagle or The Zero Theorem. I finally ripped the new Bandmade album in the week before that episode. And I ripped it at 320 kbps, 48k, you know, the highest iTunes can do. And I kind of forgot to change my settings back. So that was a really high, those two episodes audio wise were really high quality, at least the recordings were. Anyway, on to some feedback. This is from Denny Meeks on Twitter in reference to last week's episode, Zero Theorem. He said, "I'm really surprised by your rating on this one. I'm a Gilliam fan, but honestly found this so tedious it was hard to get through when I saw it at the theater. Incoherent and meandering. Waltz was good, but despite Gilliam's style, it was pretty poor execution, in my opinion." Now, I think a lot of it was because we really both, for different reasons, really related to Cohen.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Because I really didn't see it as meandering. And Gilliam, I think you kind of expect meandering out of Gilliam, don't you? Mm-hmm. He's never been a to-the-point kind of guy.
Gilliam is someone who throws a lot of shit at the wall. You know, it's a matter of what you notice. It's not even what sticks.
Right.
But I think because, you know, we both connected to Cohen so much, we were just really rooting for him.
Oh, yeah.
And also for me, the message of the film was close to home. So, you know, we were more invested into the movie for that reason. All right. Also on Twitter, Bodo, in reference to this week's episode, said, "I can get caught up with next week's, oh, never mind. I've seen Pulp Fiction about 100 times, only straight through once. The rest catch it on TV until it's slow. Click Adult Swim, here I come. Millennials, don't forget us, baby boomers, birth, short attention spans." Speaking of Adult Swim, thank you for the reminder, Bodo. Completely apropos of nothing, but since I found out yesterday, and we have talked about it, the new seasons of Fooly Cooly have release dates. Season 2, subtitled Progression, will be premiering on June 2nd, and Season 3, subtitled Alternative, will be premiering in August on Toonami. I can't wait.
There goes the neighborhood.
Fortunately, I think they're being released weekly, you know, one episode at a time. So,
oh, okay.
And it won't be like, I don't think they'll be releasing at 11 p.m. Eastern on a Wednesday night, so I'll have time to watch it and it won't get in the way of the show.
All right.
All right, so on to this week's movie, finally. Which is from 1994, Pulp Fiction. As far as the audio podcast goes, this is episode 350, and we always do something special in the 50s.
Yeah, I can't believe we're doing this, honestly. I still can't believe we're doing this. Watching it, I couldn't believe we're doing this.
Actually, this is the second time we've done this. Just to just talk about this off the top. Back when we were doing the Tuesday afternoon show, our sketch comedy show that was our first podcast, we did special things for the two April Fool's Day shows that we did, and this was the second one, yeah.
I was thinking this was an April Fool's episode that we had done.
The second April Fool's Day show. The first was Macbeth. And the way we did it is we substituted all the characters in the movie for the character voices that we were doing at the time.
Well, right. For those of you not familiar with the Tuesday afternoon show, it was sort of like the Muppet Show, where with just the two of us doing all of the voices for the Muppets.
Yeah, I think we were up to maybe 10 voices each by the end.
Right. So we did the entire movie of Pulp Fiction, with which I did listen to a little bit of tonight before the show.
I forgot to.
It was hard to find online, actually, but I did.
What, our version?
Yes.
It's on the website, on zombietakeout.com. This is a little plug. On zombietakeout.com, on the sidebar.
I went to that, and I wasn't able to play it. Mark?
Oh, it wasn't?
Yeah, I wasn't able to play it off our site.
I will have to look into that. But it says TAS question mark. That leads you to
all
the episodes of the Tuesday Afternoon Show. I will look into the technical issue.
The one thing I'd forgotten about it that hits you right away was I did the narration stage directions.
Oh, okay.
That's the voice of John McLaughlin.
Oh, wow.
Which is, I think, we may have done also for Macbeth, which was even more insane, honestly, because that was, 4 hours? Mm-hmm. It was something really nutty.
Like a 24-hour edit. And I don't mean 24 hours from start to finish. I mean 24 hours of actual editing.
Right. And we did a lot of recording sessions for that one, because we brought in a guest, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway. To the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by mayonnaise. Don't.
And also brought to you by the $5 shake. Whether you prefer it in Martin and Lewis or Amos and Andy, you'll remember when $5 used to be a lot of money for a milkshake.
Or anything.
Yeah, I know. Like, oh, 1994. What a great year for movies, but how distant in the past it is now.
Yeah.
All right. So, we think we begin. Well, we have Vincent, who's coming back from Europe. He'd been...
I just connected Vincent.
What?
Vinny? Vincent Vinny Barbarino.
Yeah. Come on, though. How much of this was added in when he realized he had Travolta?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. The whole dance scene, yeah.
The dance scene, and even just the random use of the word disco. Mm-hmm. But anyway... we have Vincent, who is returning from laying low in Europe for who knows what he had done. He's driving on the way to a new job with Jules, and really, I guess what happened was their boss Marcellus had made some sort of deal with these college kids or whatever. They never explain what it is exactly.
And they're in suits that had to have been left over from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes, definitely. And they're not even sure why they're dressed like that either, honestly. But they are. Yes, they have a briefcase of Marcellus's that they're to retrieve. And you know what? I'm going to do something odd. I'm going to do this in chronological order, if I can.
Wait, that's... Well, it's kind of fitting given... Well, actually, most of the movie is in chronological order.
No, it's not.
Well, the individual stories are told in chronological order. Most of them.
No, they're not. Because, we have... You know, he roughs them up. He shoots up the place. Then... And this is, of course, what happens towards the end of the movie, but it's still in this actual action. Right. There's someone hiding in the bathroom that comes out guns blazing, but he's just a dumb kid, or there was an act of God. Hmm. He missed them with every shot he took.
Yeah.
And they of course, off him, bring one of the kids along with him, and... Well,
they're there to pick up the briefcase, and they run into these three guys in the apartment. I think you kind of skipped over that part.
Well, and Vincent has a bit of a problem just with using his gun, and it creates a bit of a mess. And they need to, of course, get clean. They need to get everything cleaned and taken care of. And so they do that. They come back to the boss to tell him everything's cool. They have this odd run-in with a boxer who is about to take a dive. You know, he's on the take from Marcellus, their boss. Vincent and this boxer have a weird staring off at the bar that we're not sure why, really, that happened in the first place. It's never explained. It, of course, comes back in the end. That stare off is very relevant. Mm-hmm. But why it happened in the first place, we don't know.
Well, but the stare off had to have happened before the incident toward the end of the movie. Because what happened toward the end of the movie?
Oh, you know what? I skipped before that. They, of course, go and have breakfast before that.
Mm-hmm. I never connected in the meeting with Marcellus is after.
Yes, because they have the clothes.
Right.
The goofy clothes. When you're first watching it, you're like, why are they dressed like that? What happened to their clothes? Yeah. Kind of thing. And it never gets explained. But yes, mm-hmm. they have breakfast at a restaurant. The restaurant gets held up. But luckily, Jules is able to kind of talk. Well, actually, Jules, who is deciding he's getting out of this fucking business. So he pretty much just says, take the money, but you got to leave the briefcase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that's how the movie went, that would be the end of Samuel Jackson's movie, which is why it is not told chronologically.
Yeah.
Vincent, of course, also has agreed to take out Marcellus's wife.
And they talk about that as they're on the way to the hit.
Yes.
The beginning of the movie.
And that's part of the conversation in the hit.
And the date happens in the next vignette, which is why I meant that it happens chronologically.
Just about. So,
for the most part.
He takes Marcellus's wife out. As good as she looks, though, I think after, as time would go on, I would have probably just ran out of the building. Because, I mean, rumor has it the last guy that did this got a little too familiar. Some mm-hmm. say it was a foot massage. Some say they don't know what happened. But whatever it is, Tony Rocky Horror got burned out of a window.
Love that reference.
I always wonder if they were ever going to do a prequel, you know, with Tony Rocky Horror and stuff and explain what happened there. But so instead he takes her to this restaurant. Of course, he's shot up. He's gotten some American heroin to shoot up with. But he didn't shoot all of it up. He just, you know, leaves some of it in his coat.
Mm-hmm.
They're at this restaurant. He's a gentleman, though. He dances with her, and they win this prize, and they come back.
He doesn't want to be killed.
He's being a gentleman. He gives her his coat to wear, which is, of course, where the heroine comes back into play.
Of course.
Because she finds it in the spare pocket and just decides what his is hers. And she snorted it, though, which was
the problem. I think she thought it was cocaine because she did cocaine earlier in the movie. In the bathroom at the restaurant, she did a line.
Right. So that was the problem. And he has to take her back to his dealer and hopefully get her to not die. So I'm trying to think what happens next chronologically.
The fighter.
Oh, then the boxing match actually occurs. Mm-hmm. And he does not take his dive. His ass does not go down to the fifth. And he has to run. But there's just one problem.
Well, not only did he not take the dive that he had agreed to, but he accidentally killed the other boxer.
Well, yeah, that happens in boxing. But yeah, worse so, he did not take the dive. And the second MacGuffin, of course, is this watch that was handed down from generation to generation
in a very interesting way.
In the back seat of Volkswagen
in an uncomfortable place.
Yeah, secure the make and model of the car. Damn it.
The backseat of a Volkswagen bug, if I recall correctly.
Backseat of a Volkswagen bug, you got it. It was hidden there. And of course, you know, the great dynamic between Butch and his girlfriend, of him just completely going apeshit insane, making her upset, and being, oh, baby, I'm sorry.
Terrifying turn on his part, because he's ripping the place apart and then he's the dead calm.
Right. Just like, oh, did I go too far? Oh, yeah. But I mean, of course, he's Raging Bull, you know.
And surprisingly, there's only 10 years between Bruce Willis and Maria de Medeiros, who played his girlfriend, Fabiana.
I forgot how young Bruce Willis was at one point.
Because he looks like twice her age.
Yeah. But yeah, he looks so young for what we're used to seeing now.
Oh, yeah.
So he has to go back to his apartment to get his watch that she did not pack. And of course, everybody was waiting there for him. Well,
no, just Vincent.
He caught them on a break. Since Jules is wandering the earth like King from Kung Fu, the boss was there but was picking up coffee and donuts. Vincent decided that was a good time to go to the bathroom.
Does he take his gun with him? Of course, he left his gun on the counter.
He leaves it on the counter. The bathroom. And that's when you see the stare-off come back again. Only problem was Butch had fixed himself some Pop-Tarts. And the key to the movie is when you have a gun, when you're holding a gun and you have your finger on the trigger, you got to be really steady.
Yeah. You don't want any distractions, any jostling, any surprises.
Right. So he takes off, runs into, which one of my favorite scenes in all of cinematic history, I think, the scene where he's pulled up to the stop, the red light. Marcellus is walking with the thing of coffee and donuts, and you get this look between the two of them, the I know you kind of subtext, but in Ving Rhames' language, it's
motherfucker.
To which Butch responds
by stepping on the car,
running him over. The two have this crazy shootout, fight, chase in the middle of town, and just as about one is about to finish the other one off, it gets weird.
Yeah.
They,
you have quite what is probably the most famous reference from the movie that we used in the intro.
It's well, I think of course the Royale with cheese.
Oh yeah, that's one of them too. As well.
But it just if you thought everything else I was describing up until now, if you have not seen this movie, was weird. This gets weird. And really, of course, if it was going chronologically, you would have one of them, the last line would be, Zed is dead, and they would drive off into the...
Mm-hmm.
And hilarity ensues.
And actually, that engine noise opens the movie. The motorcycle with Butch and Fabiana.
Oh, you're right.
It's when you see the titles, you hear that engine just as it fades into the first scene.
Okay.
And I love the structure of this movie, how it's got these sort of nested stories that kind of move through time. Reminds me of Cloud Atlas, which came out about 10 years after. So, and it's Cloud Atlas is my absolute favorite book. I'm obsessed with it. It was 10 years after. So I'm wondering if David Mitchell, the author of Cloud Atlas, borrowed some inspiration from Pulp Fiction.
Well, I was trying, yeah, watching it critically for the first time. I mean, because I've seen it, I've seen it start to finish maybe a handful of times. It's been probably since we did that TAS episode like 10 years ago. Was it 10? No, it was 12, wasn't it?
Yeah, about 12 years ago. Because it was just over 10 because it was after you moved.
It was towards the end. That was like the final.
It was 2007 because it was the year we did it, over whatever VoIP we were using at the time. It was after you moved to Chicago.
11 years ago. Wow. Yeah. Then it was like the second to the last episode we did.
Yeah.
But so that was probably the last time I've probably seen it one more time since then. start to finish, but I've seen pieces of it here and there all the time.
Yeah, I've seen it in total once on TV, so probably not much more recent than you have.
But watching it critically for the first time, I'm, you know, trying to think, did it really need to be told, you know, non-chronologically like this?
I don't think it needed it, but it gave it a hook.
But so I figured the way to test it would be to give the plot summary in chronological order. Yeah. And I think, yes, because you get Samuel L. Jackson. Well,
yeah, that's the only difference.
Spread out through it.
Right. You don't get him at the end. He kind of disappears midway through.
And really, that speech at the end that he gives is really, if you want to find a message to the movie, that's it. That we're not just randomly floating around, that you know, there's meaning to it, and if you don't have it, you need to go out and find it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of influence, this owes a huge debt to Slackers.
Yeah,
the Linklater film, you know, where that changes stories as people cross paths. You know, this which of course was hugely influential to a lot of things. The movie opens with the definitions of pulp, and pulp novels are the movie opens. Well, yeah, I'm forgetting we don't have edits on the show. Can you hear me again now?
Yes.
What I was saying is the movie opens with the different definitions of pulp. And it's interesting. I found it interesting that the pulp novels are basically literary B movies.
Oh, sure.
I had never thought about that before.
Definitely. I mean, it's really one of the reasons we started doing this, because it's, you know, it's an art form like any other. Okay. And there's just levels of literature, and there's levels of movie scripts.
And I loved the cell phone bank robbery strategy that what's his name? In Tim Roth's character. I can't think of his.
Oh.
I have it in my notes. Pumpkin. Tim Roth's character is talking about these different bank robber strategies. And he talks about one where someone was sent into the bank with a cell phone and had said, you know, the person on the other end of the phone has my daughter. And they hand the phone to the teller and they said, you know, give him all the money or the kid dies. And it worked.
All right. So they just give him the money. Why wouldn't you just keep doing that still, though?
Well, I guess you don't want to test it. but of course, who knows if it's legit? You know, it's just such a beautiful strategy, given the conceit that they talk about, where banks are so insured that they don't even bother trying to stop robberies. They just let them continue.
But you got to love him building the case and the genius of knocking over a diner in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you see, well, you never know who's going to be a customer of the diner.
Exactly.
And it's a great idea to knock over a diner.
Especially
unless there's two hitmen.
And one of whom who wants to become a hero.
Yeah.
But the cuts for the different sections were perfect. Because, you know, Pumpkin and Honey Bunny just get up, you know, with the guns and say, and everybody, you know, hands on the table, whatever they said when they were about to do the robbery, and then it cuts to Jules and Vincent.
Yeah, it's him just saying, everybody be cool, this is a robbery, and Amanda Plummer, you know, I'm gonna execute every last motherfucker. Yeah, yeah. You know, goddamn Amanda Plummer, I wish her role was bigger in this. Yeah.
And then it cuts to Jules and Vincent, which it was almost foreshadowing.
Right, you had no idea that the two were actually gonna come together in the end.
And I love how random Jules and Vincent's conversations are.
Right. And it's just like he's picking up where he left off with Reservoir Dogs, obviously, where they're talking about Madonna and stuff. Like, very random, these gangsters talking about that shit.
And a conversation in reality would be that random.
Well, true. And of course, you would ask him how Europe was. And I mean, it is all from a natural place. None of that stuff was really that, it wasn't extraneous. It was, you could see all of that stuff happening. He's back in the States for the first time, and he's taking out the big man's wife.
Right. Although the foot massage conversation does get a bit philosophical. Like, what constitutes a foot massage? Is it a sexual thing or not? You know,
my feet are tired.
Would you give a foot massage to a man? That was a great checkmate.
Oh, yeah. Fuck you.
And I loved at the end, let's get into character.
Right.
We're trying to go into the apartment for the guys.
So the good cop, bad cop, let's get into character.
I have to say, I have mixed feelings about the briefcase.
Well, I think about those two scenes together, too, that they have Jules and Vincent, though. I mean, you have the Royale with Cheese scene and then the Ezekiel scene.
Right.
Back to back.
Bit of trivia, since you mentioned the quote. The passage from the Bible that Jules had memorized was mostly made up by Tarantino and Jackson.
Of course, yeah. There's
no... Part about the righteous man and the tyranny of evil men was not real.
Right.
However, the second half, and I will strike down with upon the yada yada yada, is from Ezekiel.
I mean, yeah, of course I looked up the passage and everything. It just, no. Does not exist.
Now, the briefcase thing, I like that it's left. I kind of like that it's left to your imagination, but I still want to know. It's that sci-fi geek in me that wants all of the phlebotinum and all of the detail. But I appreciate that it was this you know, black box, effectively.
It's great, though. I mean, it's just so obvious. This is a MacGuffin. You don't need to know what the fuck
it
is.
Exactly.
But they're going to tantalize you with it so much, especially in the end with her, where she, or Amanda Plummer's like, come on, what is it? And you really expect him to say it, but he doesn't.
Right, right.
Is that what I think it is? Son of a bitch.
And speaking of things that set up mystery, the bandage on the back of Marcellus's head.
Yeah.
Ving Rhames had just cut himself shaving that day. That's all there was to it. But a bandage. And Tarantino decided to make it a thing to like get you to wonder what why it's there. There's a theory that the glowing thing in the briefcase is Marcellus's soul.
Which doesn't make any fucking sense.
No. it was extracted. It's, you know, in a lot of mythology, that's how the soul is extracted, through the back of the head. So it explains the Band-Aid. It doesn't fit the movie beyond that. You know, obviously Tarantino's never said anything because he wants it to be a mystery.
Well, right. And if it was his soul, would Pumpkin really be, is that what I think it is? Would right, he be right, like, right. Is that a soul?
And I don't think, you know, if there was a soul, that Marcellus's would be beautiful.
Exactly.
Now here, then we get to the date between Marcellus's wife and Vincent. And there's one bit at the beginning of it that is one of my very few criticisms of the movie. She says something about him being a square, and she does this thing, you know, with their fingers, you know.
Yes.
And they actually show the dotted line as she's doing the square.
Is your problem that it's a rectangle?
Well, no, actually, I didn't think about that. It just kind of breaks the reality of the movie a little bit.
Well,
it's a very straightforward movie beyond that. I mean, structure aside.
Not exactly. I mean, the very stylized version of him driving before that, which you can kind of explain because he's, you know, kind of, he just shot up.
Well, and true. Yeah.
But there's a very, like, surreal quality to all of that.
But yeah, he had just shot up, so it made sense.
So you could justify that, but really, when Butch is taking the cab ride after the fight, I'm not sure why the scene was like that.
True, it does play around with reality a little bit, but like this dotted rectangle on the screen just was a little too much for me.
The cab ride that Butch takes, it's a fucking black and white film behind them. Is the background?
Is it?
It looks like that.
Second time I saw it, so I didn't catch that. Wow, I'm gonna have to go back and watch.
It's a black and white film, for fuck's sake. There was no color in any of the background behind them.
Wow. Okay.
Like, they're using green screen. Like, not even. I mean, he's not hiding that it's a green screen in any of his driving scenes. But yeah, in the one with Butch, I swear it's a black and white film that they're using behind him.
I'm going to have to go back and watch.
like some 1940s film of LA or whatever behind them. Mm-hmm. It just like doesn't make any sense. So yeah, he's playing with everything in this, you know, he's playing with chronology, mm-hmm. he's playing with reality. And that's why people are willing to say that that was Marsalis's soul
in
the briefcase, even mm-hmm. though no one would like recognize what a soul looks like.
And so on the date, she insists on going to this place called Jackrabbit Slim's, which is a 50s diner, you know, including a waiter dressed as Buddy Holly and all of this stuff. And
did you recognize who was Buddy Holly?
Steve Buscemi.
Yes.
And there's this great tracking shot as Vincent is trying to find her in the restaurant and pretty much walking around the entire thing. It really sold how lost he was at the place.
Yeah.
And I've never appreciated Link Ray's rumble before seeing it in this movie.
Really?
They're talking and they have this kind of lull, extended lull going on, and it's in the background. And I never really liked the song until this movie.
Ah, it's always been such a striking piece. I mean, yeah, I probably can remember maybe Michael Mann used it mm-hmm. when he did like Crime Story or something like that. But yeah, it's always had like this, you know, kind of like almost like Boleros, you know.
Yeah, it's very simple. Ravel, I think I'm thinking about guitar. Since I'm a guitar player, I'm thinking playing it. So it's just these three chords and then wait, and then these three chords and then wait.
Oh yeah.
A little bit of lead. You know,
that's the drama of it, you know.
Yeah. But I was thinking of it as playing it, which is a little boring. But in this case, I really got a sense of the mood of it.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And also, I remember when you used to be able to smoke indoors.
You know, yeah, that was the other part of this. I'm like, wow, you were able to smoke inside in 1994? I kept trying to remember that.
I quit almost 5 years ago. And so, you know, I remember being able to do it 10 years ago.
I think I remember Indiana, you're able to do it like within the last 10 years at least.
Although they were smoking while eating.
It's a diner.
But I mean, while they were eating, you know, not after. I did that once. Only once. Bad idea. Also loved the use of Chuck Berry's Never Can Tell during the twist.
It's so iconic, you know? Mm-hmm. Despite being as old as it was at the time that this came out, it's forever tied with this movie, really.
And it's Chuck Berry. His music is just timeless to begin with. Yeah, and Buddy Holly, I'm a huge fan of both. Showing them dancing with no dialogue was an interesting choice.
Right.
Because you would expect something to be intercut where the two of them kind of whispering to each other or whatever. They're just dancing.
Yeah. I mean, you can judge for yourself how good the dancers they were.
I mean, they weren't professionals, and the characters weren't professionals. They were a mobster's wife, so you know, if the dancing was a little off, it fit. And just another comment about this whole opening: it's interesting that Tarantino chose two hitmen to essentially be his voice in the movie, because they're his voice. You know, they're the director's commentary.
I guess you could say they're Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Yeah, they're,
good call.
You know.
And showing Mia's face when he finds her body was great.
Yeah.
Because she overdoses and she falls and you just see her face. And they stay on her face when he finds her.
Oh, yeah. I'm not exactly sure about the whole physiology of what would happen if you did that.
Yeah.
And how long you'd actually have before
I'm not interested in questioning that, you know. It's, you know, the movie is stylized enough. I don't need to nitpick the reality of it too much. Speaking of realistic, though, when Vincent literally drove into Lance's house, like he hit the side of the house.
Yes.
He didn't go through the wall. He just hit the house, which was nice. Because I'm so sick of, you know, literally driving through a house.
Right, I mean, he was trying to stop, too. He just came into the driveway so hard that...
Well, under the front lawn.
Right, he you know, couldn't stop it in time, and it just kind of hit the house and not drive through it.
Now, did Christopher Walken's monologue need to be so long?
Yes. I wish it was. I could have gone for another half hour, but I think
it leads to an interesting place. But he just kind of went along too long, and I think the watch up the ass bit was just a little too comedic for that point in the movie, because they had just had the overdosing, and you know.
Would you dare change that though? I wouldn't trade that in for anything.
In isolation, it's brilliant. But I just think it's kind of it kind of plays, it erects the mood a little bit.
I mean, the fact that he's playing it straight and it's Christopher Walken talking about this watch was up my ass. Yeah. Just say with a straight fucking face.
Because well, Walken says everything with a straight face. That's what he does. That's his genius. He can say the most absurd, outlandish things with a dead straight face.
I mean, there are just so many people that he worked into this movie. It's almost like watching a mad world.
Yeah.
And how he got all these people in for like this crazy little budget is just mind-boggling.
Right. Now, I think the movie might be a little too long.
It is long, yes.
It's 2.5 hours. I mean, it covers a lot of ground, but I think maybe it could have been shorter.
I mean, really, the only part that doesn't move anything along is the date.
Yeah, true.
If there was a part to take out, it was the date with. But you know, you can't let that go.
You can't in hindsight because it's iconic. But you're right; it really doesn't accomplish anything.
Right.
In the movie. That's it. I never thought about that. Oh, going back to the watch real quick. Its backstory is kind of ironic given what it leads to.
Oh, yeah. Of course. And in fact, it's kind of the point. I think like the other thing with the date is kind of a foreshadowing in a way.
Yeah.
Because the last person that shook her hand that we know
right.
got tossed up, out the window,
right.
And then he winds up shaking her hand at the end,
right,
and
you're right.
Kind of like, yeah, she's cursed.
Although it wasn't Marcellus that got to him.
Well, right, it wasn't Marcellus, right.
And it's really shocking to see Vincent get shot when there's an hour left to the movie.
Right.
Because you kind of figure he's a main character. He's going
to be at the end.
And even you know, having seen it a long time ago, knowing he does make it to the end of the movie, or he is in the end of the movie, I was like, wait, how does... Oh, right, non-chronological.
The beauty of changing the chronology.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure how I feel about the meaning of GIMP changing. Because Bring Out the GIMP is, of course, the icon, one of the iconic bits of the movie. And it's this guy in this leather BDSM suit. GIMP was originally a slur for disabled people, and for those who might be new who have been with us, I have to announce this every so often. I'm in a wheelchair. I really don't know how I feel about that. I kind of have mixed feelings. I do have to admit, I was busy drooling over some of the 80s guitars in the pawn shop. I saw guitars that looked just like that in Guitar Player back in the day. And I loved the weapon selection, speaking of the pawn shop, when he goes to save Marcellus. You know, he drops a bat and then a chainsaw.
That whole sequence is just, I mean, after the confusion and just the... then the whole, I'll do it, but I'll hate myself in the morning look he gives when he's on the way out. But like, okay, I'll do it. Mm. And yeah, and then upgrading.
Yeah, he should have stuck with the chainsaw or at least the bass. You know, there's a bass guitar. Those things are fucking heavy. That's probably about 8 pounds.
You have a chance to use a samurai sword in a fight, though.
Maybe it's because I have a sword collection. It's not that big of a deal to me.
Yeah, but you don't have the chance to use the sword.
Fair point. But as someone who owns one and has you know, practiced with it quite a bit, you know, if there's a baseball bat or a bass guitar there, something big and heavy, or better yet, a chainsaw, that's what I'm going to go with. I'm not going to trust myself with a katana if I got to throw down.
Of course, the problem is you don't know how sharp the katana is.
Well, that too.
What if he came in and it was just, you know, ceremonial or whatever, right, not really,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah, if it was an unsharpenable blade, you're screwed. You know, if that chainsaw starts, that's what I'm taking with me.
you just need to find a boomstick to go with it.
Yeah. And if the chainsaw doesn't start, I'm grabbing the base.
Yeah.
You know, the katana was just not a smart choice. And where does a boxer learn to use a katana like that? I said I'm not complaining about the reality of it, but yeah. He was a boxer who was like pulling off these samurai moves.
Now, is that the same sword from Kill Bill?
I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to check. Just
how great would it be if she winds up like pawning the sword off at the end and, you know,
yeah.
It's in the, that shop.
Right, right. Now we get to, you know, we return to the Jules and Vincent when after, you know, Butch and Fabiana drive off and give us the motorcycle sound from the beginning.
Yeah.
And Marvin's shooting shouldn't have been funny, but it was.
Oh,
Phil Lamar's character. Great to see Phil Lamar in the movie. Been a fan since
TV.
He's done a lot of voice work too in animation. But yeah, I had to laugh when that happened because it takes you by such surprise.
And it's just so stupid. And one of the things you realize from this scene alone is that Vincent is a real fucking head case. I mean, he gets surly with the wolf. He
and when he gets so surly, as you put it, with the wolf, I have to admit, I was kind of glad for what happened to him.
Right, he gets surly with Jimmy. I mean, they show up to the guy's house with you know, dead end storage, I guess you could say.
quick thing about. One real quick thing to interject real fast. Since I just saw my notes, I forgot to mention. Zed and Maynard are brothers.
Yes.
It's in the screenplay. They don't mention it in the movie. Kind of brings a whole new dimension to that scene. Anyway, back to Vincent and the wolf. Love the wolf. He's probably my favorite character in the movie. I just love how efficient and professional he is.
Apparently... it's the same character Harvey Keitel played in Point of No Return the year before.
Oh, okay.
Like he was known as like the cleaner or whatever, but he just decided to like keep that character and put him in this. but right, he gives shit to Willie. He gives shit or not Willie, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. He gives shit to the wolf. He doesn't even really appreciate that they're still alive after, you know, the kid rang off all these shots at them.
Right, right.
And he's just, oh, you know.
Well, I'm kind of have his back on that one. Because Jules is saying it's a miracle. It was a lucky break.
True.
Plain and simple. And that's all Vincent was saying. They got lucky. Got to take his back on. Got to have his back on that one. But after bouncing off to the wolf, who was just there to save them and was an absolute professional about it, I was kind of glad Vincent got shot.
Pretty pleased with the fucking trigger and top. The car. but no, I mean, if someone charges at you and rings out a bunch of shots and manages to miss every single one of them, that is a life evaluating moment.
It is a life evaluating moment.
Whether you think it's a miracle or if you just got lucky.
So it's something you should be very happy about. And
just,
you know,
be like, I'm going to take the big guy's daughter out on a date tonight.
Yeah, true. Speaking of daughters,
it was his wife. I mean, did I say daughter?
Well, you conveniently gave me a segue.
Okay.
Because I completely forgot you and Leah Sweeney was in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize Rosanna Arquette.
Yeah, with all the piercings.
This is like the first time I realized, wait a minute, that's Rosanna Arquette. I mean, she's only in it for like, 30 seconds at most.
And same thing with Julia Sweeney. Was this before SNL? Because she looked very young.
No, because she was Pat and stuff. She was on she was on with like Phil Hartman and stuff.
Oh, right, that was late 80s, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this might have been right after. Because she looked really young in it.
It's also a very young Kathy Griffin in this as well.
She picks up Marcellus after runs into him, as you put it.
Yeah. Rosanna Arquette, though, you only hear like she's off camera more than she's on. You're yelling at.
Right.
What was Tim Roth's character's name?
It was Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz, Lance.
Lance, okay.
who, you know, as you're seeing him as the drug dealer, you're like, that was originally supposed to be Marty McFly, of course.
Well, that was going to be Michael J. Fox?
They originally casted him, man.
I didn't know that. Oh,
and it just didn't work out.
Oh, that would have been amazing. That would have been amazing. So they get the car cleaned up and they go to the diner. And this really could have been Jules' origin story. You know, for the hero that he's trying to become.
Yeah. And I mean, does that bring us to sequels and remakes?
Well, yeah. Is there really much else to talk about with the diner scene? You know, they stopped the robbery. There was a deleted scene in which Jules kind of has as this fantasy about what he could have done when, you know, Pumpkin is on top of him. He shoots him, spins around, shoots Bunny, and, you know, kind of, you know, stops it. And then he wakes up.
It doesn't make any sense for Jules to have a fantasy because he's fucking done it.
Right, and, right,
I mean, him not taking not you out.
Fantasy, just a calculation of, you know, I'll shoot him, then I'll shoot her. And then, you know, someone else gets shot when she falls. And I think it's better to just show him calmly talking them down and kind of trying to move on to a new life.
Yeah. Of course, one of Travolta's best lines, you give him that money, I'm going to shoot him out of principle.
One last bit of trivia. The screenplay was written in 92 and 93 and incorporated some scenes originally written by Roger Avery for True Romance.
Okay.
Yeah, so there was a connection. Between this, True Romance, and Natural Born Killers is this sort of weird interplay.
Well, I mean, you know, Travolta, Vincent Vega was supposed to be, what's his name from Reservoir Dogs?
Michael Madsen, right. Yeah.
And from what I understand, Michael Madsen got cast in Wyatt Earp.
Okay.
So he saw the big Kevin Costner movie in The Paycheck.
Right.
And of course.
And I mean, a logical choice for him. And I think it wouldn't have been nearly as interesting with Madsen as Vincent.
I think you're right. I think this is Travolta's best role, hands down.
Oh, yeah. And just the chemistry between him and Samuel L. Jackson. Yeah. I don't know if that would have been there with Madsen.
Yeah, I mean, Reservoir Dogs is on its own a classic.
Well, but, yeah, of course.
But yeah, the two of them together in this. Right. That's why the Royale with Cheese scene is just so...
right.
Iconic.
Yeah. And then it's just so random.
And that Mad TV, of course, spoofed this movie with Bill Maher.
Yeah. Which I don't think I appreciated at the time because I hadn't seen the movie. On to sequels and remakes. Now, you want a prequel with, what was his name?
You could do so much from this, of course, you know, like, because there were so many characters in it.
Right.
But yeah, you could have like Tony Rocky Horror.
How could I forget that?
You'd figure out why they called him Tony Rocky Horror, of course.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see a sequel following Jules walking the earth as a hero.
Of course. They could have made a series off that, you know? Oh. I mean, how many shows have they done with the guy just wandering from aimlessly from town to town
since
or whatever? Yeah, it could have just been The Fugitive with Samuel L. Jackson, you know, Jules
Winfield. Right. Yeah. Well, it wouldn't have been The Fugitive because he's not really wanted at this point.
Ah, you'd have somebody chasing after him just to make the plot of the show.
He gets away from Earth. I mean, it's one of the probably, now that I'm thinking about it, it hadn't occurred to me, but it's one of the most unrealistic things in the movie. He leaves the life clean.
Oh, yeah. And presumably. I guess... Yeah, Marcellus seems like he's ready to forgive pretty easily, actually, doesn't he?
Well, he forgives Butch because he saves his ass, literally.
Yeah. That he does.
I would love to see what he would have done to Zed.
Oh, no.
I would. Whoever did Saw, I don't know his name on that, right. But I would love to see him direct that scene.
Eli Roth.
Yeah.
But yes.
Because he mentions pliers. He shot
pliers
him
and blow
with a shotgun.
Yikes. SVTV, you, and to be his short, miserable life.
Yeah. Underbrains.
on the brim. Is there a mystery to this?
I mean, well, for me, perhaps, not for you, but it's not really. I mean, I had a couple of minor criticisms that could have been shorter. I do think Walken's monologue went on too long and was a little too comedic for that spot in the movie, and I do have a little issue with the rectangle. But it's still, it's Tarantino's masterpiece. I mean, he's had missteps since then, but he really did nail it this time. I got to go 5.
Yeah, it's our 350th episode, so we took a week off. We've had a lot of really good movies, but I have a feeling that's about to change, isn't it?
Well, we'll see. This is our second perfect score of the year. I think we're starting
for me.
Consecutive. Well, it's a perfect score, so it's both of us. It's our second double 5 consecutive too. Before we get to that, what have we learned?
What have I learned? What haven't I learned? My feet, you know. I have too many notes is what I learned.
Oh, okay. And I learned a good use for a cell phone. All right, so that's it for Pulp Fiction. If you enjoyed this video, please give it a like and subscribe if you haven't. Down in the description, you'll find the trailer for Pulp Fiction, as well as a link to its IMDb page, a link to the trailer, not the embedded trailer, and all of our links, social networks, links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes to the audio version, our voicemail, our email address, all of that good stuff. And until next time, we'll be reviewing Americathon. I have hope for this one. You said it was the most 70s thing you've ever seen when you saw the trailer.
Well, I think our viewers need to be treated to us getting the claws out. So,
well, yeah. Well, we've got some coming up in a few weeks that I think. I think Americathon is good. We've got Perfume after that with a guest. Shortly after that, I think, we've got the Stone trilogy after that.
Oh.
After Perfume.
Okay.
I think that's going to be the treat for the viewers.
All right.
Particularly the third one, The Hand. I have no idea what that's going to be.
It will be a treat for us, though.
Well, I think that's kind of mutually exclusive, a treat for them and a treat for us. We've got a movie called Mythica, The Dark Spore that stars Kevin Sorbo. It's a sword and sorcery thing.
Oh, jeez. Fuck.
And then we've got a Julie Strain movie called Sorceress after that.
Okay.
You want to see the claws? That's when you're going to see the claws.
All right.
Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.